Oh, well, it pleases me greatly to call on Brother Tech for Esther, an unlikely saviour. This is day two of the 52nd New Zealand Christadelphian Bible School. Our third period speaker is Brother Tech Morgan on Esther, an unlikely saviour. The subtitle for today is Queen Esther Chosen. This is the first talk in his series. The introductory reading is Esther 1. Brother Tech.
Thank you, Darren. Good evening, everyone. You should be feeling really good, you know, because Darren looks out at you, sees all your crowded faces, and then says, and the teens can now leave to go to the study. So, obviously, you're looking younger than you were this morning, so that situation can only improve. Oh, sorry, I need to switch my... Thank you very much. Are you hearing me better now? You are, okay. Well, I feel a little bit like a history teacher at the moment, and I'm not a history teacher, because we were looking earlier on when we were studying 1 Peter at the background and the circumstances, and we've got to do the same again when we come to the book of Esther, because, of course, we could, being familiar with the story, we could make all sorts of types and patterns and shadows out of Esther without realizing the significance and the importance of the background here. And when you come to fill out the background, your view of the characters that are portrayed in this remarkable narrative might well be different from what you were expecting. Of course, we're very fortunate as Bible students who understand the scriptures of truth because we've a timeline through ancient history. Ancient history can be a maze and a confusion, but of course God is really only interested in those nations that had control of the land of Israel, and that timeline through Daniel chapter 2 is very helpful to us, as are of course the amplified details that come in Daniel's chapter 7 and 8. We know, don't we, of the pattern of Babylon being followed then by Medo-Persia, by Greece and by Rome, and then to the divided state that will exist in the last days. And this is depicted for us in graphic terms, terms that help to stick these things in our memory. And once we have got the general shape and pattern of the way that Bible history was to unfold, then we're ready, of course, for Daniel chapter 11, where Daniel is now given enormous detail about the way that things were going to work out. So first we get the outline, then a little more detail, and then a huge amount of detail. So, for example, just to zone in for a couple of verses there in Daniel chapter 11, now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than them all. By his strength through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. So you see, by now we are down to microscopic detail. We are being told about the kings that were to come. By Daniel 11, remember, the Persians are already in charge of the then settled world. And Cambyses was to be followed by Smerdis, by Darius the First, and then by Xerxes the First. So you can work out who is the fourth of them, who is to be a richer and through his riches will stir himself up. So you know the pattern, the background here. The Jews have gone into captivity in two phases, 722 BC, when Samaria was taken by the Assyrians and the 10 tribes were dispersed, and then 586 BC, when in the third or fourth of Nebuchadnezzar's invasions, the last of the inhabitants of Judah were taken away and were to be separated from the land, which was to remain desolate for 70 years. And so the Jews were in captivity, and yet God, having watched over his people, had promised that he was with them, and though he made a full end of all nations where I have scattered you, yet I will not make a complete end of you, but I will correct you in justice and will not let you go altogether unpunished. That's Jeremiah 30 and verse 11. And so it was that when Nebuchadnezzar's day had finished, and when in course of time Belshazzar was ruling, well, together with his father, and the feast took place, Belshazzar's feast that led to the conquest, just as Jeremiah had predicted. Remember, the gates were left open, the river ran dry because of the diversion of the river under the Persian engineers. So it was that Babylon was taken, and in course of time then, it was Cyrus who decreed that the Jews were to return, just as the scripture had predicted. You come to the British Museum, and where better to go than the British Museum, you'll find the original of the Cyrus cylinder. There are facsimiles of this scattered around the museums of the world, but here's the original. And that was a cylinder that depicted the strategy that Cyrus was going to adopt. You might remember the Assyrian strategy was break the nation in pieces, scatter it to the four corners of the Assyrian Empire. They'll never come back together again. They will be lost, which is largely what happened to the 10 tribes. But the Cyrus, the Persian policy was different. Bring the people back to the land, settle them there, and get them to worship their gods, but to focus upon us in particular, and to ask blessing, so that he would be blessed by a multitude of different gods. And here out of the Cyrus cylinder is the record of the nations, not just of Israel, in fact not of Israel, on this particular cylinder, but of Asher, of Susa, of Agade, of Esnuna, Zaban, Naturna, Dur, as far as the regions of Gutium and so on. It was a strategy of sending all these different people back. And that was exactly what had been promised in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled. The Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put it in writing. So that was the declaration, that was the policy, that was the practice. The Jews then were allowed to return, and unfortunately only a small number of them in total decided to return, but that remnant through whom God was working were to return and were to rebuild the temple. So you can see the pattern there. 538 was the decree of Cyrus. Incidentally, all these details you don't need to copy down. They'll be available on the audio tapes, which you can order afterwards if you want to study the detail. So we get to a crucial point then in Israel's history where the Jews are about to return. And now one Persian emperor would be followed by another, Cambyses, Darius. And Darius would choose his son, and that is the Artaxerxes that we read about in the book of Esther. He is Xerxes the first, not the firstborn son of Darius, because Darius, in fact, chose the best of his sons. It was tough being a prince in those days. You didn't just fall into the throne because you happened to be firstborn. You had to prove your worth as a warrior who was trained from the moment of his selection. And so it was Xerxes who was a formidable person. And you might think to yourself, well, what a nice man he would have been, because God was going to give him a nice Jewish girl. Well, if you thought that, then think again. He was a very difficult man indeed, and it was going to be a very, very challenging relationship if you ever thought that you were going to end up married to him. In course of time, Xerxes would be succeeded, not again by his firstborn son, named Darius. He was in fact killed when Xerxes was himself assassinated, but Artaxerxes would come to the throne, and it would be under Artaxerxes that Ezra would go to Jerusalem, being sent, remember, to tutor and to school the Jews that were already there. He was a scribe in the law of God, and Nehemiah would be allowed to return to build the walls. So we think about the temple in the first instance, then about temple worship, then about the fortification of the city. And all sorts of things were happening in the wider world that made that a sensible move as far as Artaxerxes was concerned. Now, where does all this fit into the book of Ezra? Let's go to Ezra for a moment, and there to chapter 6, where you'll notice that we read in verse 19 of Ezra chapter 6 about this circumstance. Children of Israel kept the Passover upon the 14th day of the first month, for the priests and the Levites were purified together. The children of Israel, verse 21, which were come again out of captivity, and all such as had separated themselves unto them from the filthiness of the heathen of the land to seek the Lord God of Israel, did eat and kept the feast of unleavened bread 7 days with joy, for the Lord had made them joyful, and turned the heart of the king of Assyria unto them to strengthen their hands in the work of the house of God, the God of Israel. And this is 516 BC, and the king, in fact, was Darius. So that under Darius, then, the Jews were encouraged. And then when you look at Ezra chapter 7, we read in verse 1, "Now after these things, in the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, Ezra, the son of Seraiah, the son of Azariah, the son of Hilkiah, the son of Shalom, the son of Zadok, the son of Ahitub," and so on, Ezra went up from Babylon, verse 6, and he was a ready scribe in the law of Moses. And this is 458 BC. I mentioned to you a Tyndale bulletin earlier on. There's another Tyndale bulletin written by Stafford Wright on the date of Ezra's coming to Jerusalem, if you really wanted to pursue those things. So between those two chapters, there is a gap, in fact, of 58 years. And it's during that very time that the account of Esther has to be fitted in. So the book of Esther actually comes between those two chapters, between the reign of Darius and the reign of Artaxerxes, whom you remember was Xerxes' son. I ought to just encourage you that I'll not be issuing question sheets at the end of this, but at the same time, there is no history degree available either. Well, you'll know that not everybody is very comfortable with the book of Esther. For example, when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in Qumran, remember, the north of the Dead Sea, there were remnants of every scripture to be found there, with one exception, and the one exception was the book of Esther. At first it was thought that none of Nehemiah had survived either, but they eventually found a little scrap of Nehemiah. So just Esther. Of course, it was an unusual community. The Essenes had their particular way of worshipping. They were they were different people, take a very strict and careful view of life. And when they came to hide their scrolls away, there are two possibilities. One was that they disapproved of a book in Scripture that had a beauty contest at its heart. And the other was that Esther was so tasty that, in fact, the worms had eaten every scrap of Esther that had remained. I leave you to ponder those possibilities. But when you do visit the community remains nowadays, this is the remains of what was their settlement, you can actually walk along this area here and look down upon the first caves that were found. And then, of course, you might remember in Cave 11, the entirety of the book of Isaiah was found. And you can now see a facsimile of that as well in the shrine of the book. They did originally keep the original there, but they were worried about it being damaged. So there's a line that stretches right from the very time of the Lord Jesus Christ and these manuscripts, and you know all about the Dead Sea Scrolls. But there's another line that stretches right from the time of Esther right through to today, and that's the keeping of the Feast of Purim. And the Jews love keeping the Feast of Purim. It is their carnival, because they relish the book of Esther in a very particular way. It's a Babylonian Talmud that says, or the rabbis writing in that Talmud, that says that if all of the Old Testament scriptures were to be lost, the Pentateuch would at least survive, and with it, the book of Esther. Because for them, well, they couldn't do without their carnival time, and they obviously think that that's absolutely crucial to their national existence. And even those who are Orthodox appear to let their hair down a little on these particular occasions. And I'm sure that you know that when the book of Esther is being read during the Feast of Purim, that the children are all set up to make noises whenever the name of Haman is mentioned. They make a noise and are given rattles to rattle to try and blot out his name, and in other occasions people are cheered. So what was it all about, and what sort of people were they that the scriptures speak of? Well, As the book opens, the book of Esther, it opens with a party, and there are a lot of parties going on. The Persians liked to feast, and feasted for some considerable time, so that you read of the record of what was going on there in verse 2 of Esther 1. In those days when the king Ahasuerus, we know him to be Xerxes, if you're at all concerned about that coincidence, I can point you in the direction of some helpful scholarly writings that coincide Artaxerxes with Xerxes. In those days when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan the palace, in the third year of his reign, he made a feast unto all his princes. So immediately we're given an opportunity to see there just where the king was settled. The Persians had three administrative centres. One was Babylon, one was Persepolis, Ecbatana also were featured, but this was Susa, which was their summer palace. And Susan, or Shushan, as it's described in the authorized version here, was a palace that was originally constructed in timber, begun by Darius and later made more beautiful by Xerxes, who turned his attention to architecture after some upset in his reign. And it was later destroyed in the time of Artaxerxes, who rebuilt it in stone. So there's an interesting little development there, because we were reading of the detail of what it looked like, the colours, the tapestries, and all the rest of it. So this must have been written by someone who had an eyewitness account of what the palace existed at that time. You know, people who say, well, it was written much later, in far after these events, it was mythical and so on, miss the critical point that the person who was writing this record was familiar with what was happening. And what was happening? Well, the king was holding a party. Do you notice it says there in verse 3, in the third year of his reign, that would be 483 BC, he made a feast unto all his princes and his servants. And now, the third year of his reign is significant, because when Darius died, he had in fact suffered a revolt in Egypt, and Xerxes was sent immediately when he became the new king to quell that report in Egypt, and did so with great ferocity. So this is the third year of his reign, and he's partying, no doubt, pleased about the way things had gone as far as the Egyptian campaign was concerned, but now with his mind upon something else. And you'll notice that this feast goes on. There at verse 4, he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honour of his excellent majesty many days, even 180 days. Now, I'm sure you party well in New Zealand, but a 180-day party is something that you'd never really forget. It takes up pretty well half the year in that sense. And the record goes on to say that when these days were completed, the king made a feast lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Shushan the citadel, from great to small, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. In other words, he had a garden party after this long feast that had taken place. So what was he doing for 180 days? Was he just showing how extravagant and how good a host he was? Well, I think you have to liken it really to, in the first instance, a cabinet meeting. I would have shown you a picture of the British cabinet, but it's changing such a lot under Theresa May's government that I could never be quite sure who was likely to be there by the time I came to speak. So here's the American cabinet for you. And of course, they would be sitting discussing business. And that's what was happening for these 180 days. There was some severe business afoot, and the people had been gathered, the nobles and the princes and the rulers and the captains and the army commanders had been brought together for a long period of detailed consideration. And after that, perhaps to ease the populace of Susa, who had been suffering all this inconvenience from all these VIPs who were sitting around, a garden party took place, and the populace were invited in just to see for themselves just how marvelous it all was. Remember, the Persian Empire was a big sprawling place at this stage, divided up into satrapies, and it was carefully administered. But what was now in mind, following the Egyptian campaign, was exactly what we would expect. Attention was being turned towards Greece. Now, it wasn't the first time that the Persian Empire had tried to extend itself in that direction towards Europe, because Darius had made an attempt. He had mustered a force, and he had shipped himself and his army down towards Greece, hoping that he might push in and conquer Athens, for example, and had arrived at a bay, the bay which was the Marathon Bay, and had offloaded a considerable force there, and the Greeks had stood in opposition. If you know anything about Greek history, you might know, for example, that they were at this stage a very divided community. This was before Philip of Macedon brought them together and united them as a force. And yet they decided to stand and to fight against the Persian force. And the Persian force could be huge. In fact, when Xerxes makes his mission, it was the biggest army that had ever been assembled in the ancient world. But this was Darius's father. Darius's father had landed on the beach. The Greeks had dug in, but were concerned when they saw the force that was opposing them, and they sent a man who was their Samoa Farah equivalent, the finest athlete that they had in Greece, and he was sent off to the Peloponnese, to the Spartans, to ask if the Spartans would come and help. And in fact, he covered 140 miles in 2 days. That was the nature of his athletic prowess. And the Spartans said, sorry, they were busy with the festival at the moment and they couldn't make it, but they'd be there in 10 days. And so he ran back again and said, they're coming in 10 days. And now there was this huge force that was threatening to advance up the beach. And the Greeks just sat tight until one day they learned that they were on the move, and they came out of their defensive position and they marched towards the Persians, and they were successful. Incidentally, that's where we get the idea of marathons, from that run of Philippides when he ran. But you don't have to run 140 miles in 2 days these days. It's all been scaled down a little to more manageable proportions. So the Persians were defeated, and Darius went home with unfinished business. And you remember how accurate now Daniel's prophecy was. Through his riches he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. So that, in fact, is what Xerxes was doing at this stage. He was marshalling his men, and they made huge preparations before they invaded again. It is said by an ancient historian, who is thought to have wildly exaggerated, that as many as 1 million men were brought together to come together against the Greek forces. Modern scholars scale it down to about 200,000 with support, but even so, it was the largest army that had ever been assembled in the ancient world, and they were now going to come against Greece. So you can imagine that it took 180 days of careful planning. I mean, one of the forces that was taking place, because they were gathering triremes and galleys together, the largest navy that had ever been assembled, that they actually cut a canal through the bit of Mount Athos that went down into the Mediterranean so that they could be sure that they wouldn't have to go round that particular promontory. So there were huge preparations that were made. So that's what it was all about. And it was during that time, of course, that Queen Vashti was also making a feast for the women in the royal palace, which belonged to King Ahasuerus. And on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown, in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials. And Queen Vashti refused to come. Well, the Jews think that that was because the king was drunk, and he was asking the queen to come just wearing her royal crown, in other words, naked. But it's very unlikely that that was actually the case. I mean, the Persians were a fairly discreet and careful people in that respect, and were not for showing more flesh than was absolutely necessary. There are all sorts of other possibilities. One is that she might have been pregnant at the time, and I think that's quite a likelihood. Another was that she was drunk herself and didn't fancy tottering in on her high heels and making a spectacle of herself. Or perhaps she just decided that enough was enough and there was a line being drawn that she was not prepared to cross. And what you get now is that this mighty king, who is assembling these huge forces, who is the commander of the world in ancient terms, is now absolutely confused about what to do about his wife. The king was furious and his anger burned within him. And what does he do? He turns to his wise men and he says, "What do you think I should do about her? This is the commander of the forces. Aren't you glad that you're not a member of his army if he's so uncertain about a simple domestic matter? What shall we do to Queen Vashti according to law because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus brought to her by the eunuchs?" And of course the eunuchs were always ready to help. Well, they're part of the civil service and the civil service always works efficiently and wants to get its bonuses. And so Memucan answered before the king, "Queen Vashti has not only wronged the king, but also all the princes and all the people who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, for the queen's behavior will become known to all women, so that they will despise their husbands in their eyes." That was the advice that was given by the civil servant, and that was the advice the king took. He had better get rid of Queen Vashti, which was easier said than done. If you look at the record then, a decree was to be issued there at verse 19 of Ezra 1. "If it please the king, let there go a royal commandment from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, that it be not altered, that Vashti come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal estate unto another that is better than she. And when the king's decree, which he shall make, shall be published throughout all his empire, for it is great, all the wives shall give to their husbands honour, both to great and small." Vashti then was no longer to be the queen. And the remarkable thing is that in those words, "all the wives shall give," there in verse 20, is the first of four hidden names of Almighty God, the Tetragrammaton, YHWH, is there to be found. And the Jews picked that up early on, and in the Hebrew manuscripts have made those four consonants larger than the script that lies alongside it. So they were perfectly aware of the fact that there was something remarkable happening here. So why is it then that there is this time delay and this gap in the way things work out? Let's just summarize for a moment. Xerxes has been appointed the king. He has successfully shown his power and his military prowess in Egypt. He is now feasting and planning strategically. He spends 4 months altogether with his commanders and his army commanders. He makes enormous preparations. He, in fact, had provisions planted along the route to be able to supply the army when at last the army came. But you'll notice that in year 7, Esther comes into his presence. Look at now Esther chapter 2 and verse 16, and you'll see there, "So Esther was taken unto King Ahasuerus into his house royal in the 10th month, which is the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign." So that's 479 BC. So there we were in the first instance, in the 3rd year of his reign. Now it's 4 years later that Esther actually comes into the situation. What has been happening in the in-between? And the answer is that the campaign in Greece has taken shape and in fact has been executed. Now, it was an enormous task that befell the king. He was assembling units from all these different nations that comprised the Persian Empire, and they were, for example, to cross from Asia into Europe. They had to cross, in the first instance, the Dardanelles, which is a 3/4 mile strait known in ancient times as the Hellespont, but now as the Dardanelles. And the king, in fact, had ordered that 2 bridges were to be made out of boats. They were to be lashed together, and one was going to be for the elite troops and the other for the support troops. And in fact, the sea didn't take too kindly to that. And so, in fact, both those bridges were broken by rough sea. The king then ordered that the sea should be lashed. And so it was whipped to teach it a good lesson. And the bridge builders of both bridges were executed, all of them. And new bridges were commissioned, and the new bridges were prepared. So this huge army was now to march forward, and the record says that as it progressed towards the Hellespont, it was so extensive that it drained rivers dry. There was one particular man who offered to host the army. He was an extremely wealthy man himself, and the king was very pleased by the hospitality that it showed. And the man asked if perhaps in the circumstances his eldest son, all of his sons had been given command in the army, maybe his eldest son might be allowed to stay to look after his aged father. And the king said, "All of my sons are involved in this invasion," he said, "and this is what I will do. I will spare your life." But he had the eldest son executed and sawn in 2 and laid alongside the army that was to march. Am I painting a picture for you of the sort of man that is known for us as Ahasuerus? He was a vicious and a brutal man. But you see, as far as the Persians were concerned, that was a sacrifice that had been made that was auspicious as they were to progress. And so they moved steadily towards where they were going. And they came to Thermopylae. They came to a narrow defile in the road, a place of hot springs, where there was a marsh on one side and a cliff on the other side. And there stood a Greek army to oppose this vast group that were coming towards them. And right at the very center were 250 of the Spartans, led by one of their kings. They had 2 kings, the Spartans, Leonidas. And Leonidas and his 250 Spartans stood there together with 6,000 Greeks, and they resisted the Persian attack. There were parts of that particular defile that were only wide enough for a cart to come through, so you can understand that it was a pinch point. And for 3 days they resisted this huge army. And in fact, they left something like 20,000 of the Persians dead. And there were good reasons for that. The Greeks had longer spears than the Persians. They had better shields than the wicker shields and armoury that tended to be used. But the king, of course, had 1,000 immortals who were his personal bodyguard, pushed them forward, and they too were unable to come through. So you get a flavour of what the actual encounter was like when Greek met the mixture that were the Persian army. It is said that it took them 6 days to actually cross across the 2 bridges, so you get the sense of the size and scale of this particular encounter. And that was merely the land forces. This was the largest navy that had ever been assembled. Remember, there was a canal that had been cut so that they could have access there. And their first engagement with the Greeks was successful. But the king decided that he had better sit and watch what was to take place in the Battle of Salamis. A silver throne was placed, and he, in fact, watched a huge defeat that took place, where the Greeks, in fact, mauled the Persian fleet. And you begin to get the sense that things were not going very well at all for Xerxes. In fact, Xerxes decided at this point that he would leave his army under the command of someone else and that he would return home. And so he went home a defeated and somewhat disgruntled man. Having spent all that time, all that effort, all that energy, all that expense in attempting to make inroads towards the expansion of his empire into Greece and, of course, beyond Greece. They did manage eventually to burn Athens down, but beyond that they were quite unsuccessful. And the Spartans, incidentally, who could only have spared 250 because they were busy festivaling again at the time, and the omens were not auspicious for them to engage in their entirety, now shook themselves and began to enter in the battle. Sparta was more a battalion than a country. You were born to be a warrior. That was the nature of the event. Incidentally, of the 150, all of them were massacred except for one, who had been sent back for reinforcements, and he was so humiliated that he had survived that he committed suicide. So you get that sense of a nation that was opposing the Persians, and the king went back with his tail between his legs. So that's Xerxes for you, a nasty piece of work if ever you could meet one. And Vashti? Well, she's known in history as Amestri, and she gave birth to Xerxes' children, so that she is not a person to be lightly dismissed. How do we know all this? Because Herodotus, who is thought to be the father of modern history, has written some remarkable accounts of what was taking place at this particular time. And if you're interested, again, they're freely available on the internet. Herodotus's The Histories in 8 volumes. You want about volume 7 if you want to engage with this particular event. And he writes in a very graphic and fascinating way. And he tells us, incidentally, that Vashti had not been immediately dismissed from the presence of the king. Although she had been deposed as queen, he took her along anyway. Well, he was a man, and he needed women around him, and so she went with them. But, well, he had other dalliances while he was there, and Vashti didn't take that well, and she took her own bitter revenge of the people that he had been playing around with. And as a result, when he at last came back to Persia, now he remembered just everything that had happened. Hence, at the beginning of Esther chapter 2, we read, after these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done and what had been decreed against her. And the king's servants who attended him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. So now it was that we settle into a situation where Vashti, who has already been deposed as queen, but nevertheless was still the king's consort, and incidentally would remain in the harem when Esther eventually became queen, because you didn't get rid of a queen with her sort of influence easily. And anyway, you couldn't leave a woman who had been in close and intimate relations with the king to return to secular life. She would remain a custodian in the harem. Well, now, of course, the Persian beauty contest took place. But for all the Essenes' concern, it wouldn't have been a beauty contest like that. It would have been a much more discreet affair, and well, you'll know how intimate the selection process was going to be. The king appointed officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather together all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan the citadel into the women's quarters under the custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women, and let beauty preparations be given them. They were certainly to be thoroughly fumigated before they might be allowed to come into the presence of the king. And to an extent, that is exactly what happened. They have found archaeological remains of what would be like incinerators in which perfume would be placed to waft the incense and other things around. And so it was that everybody was being assembled then who was at all liable to be of interest to the king. And all of these people were going to be prepared and purified and perfumed before they were ready now to come into the king's presence. And it's at that stage then that we encounter this young lady who was to be so important in the presence of the king. Because in Shushan the citadel there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair. We're in Esther chapter 2 and there at verse 5. Mordecai means belonging to Merodach. Merodach was a Babylonian god, and he was clearly given a Babylonian name. He was the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar in three, if not four, tranches had stripped the nation of its rulers in the first instance, then of its craftsmen, and then eventually of its other rams, of the rest of the population. And this was during the first tranche. So Mordecai and his ascendants were in fact of royal birth, it would seem, if Kish is to be related to Saul. He was an influential person as far as the Jews were concerned. But you'll notice that he is described there as a certain Jew. And in fact, six times he is captioned as Mordecai the Jew. Comes again in chapter 5, verse 13, 6, verse 10, 8, verse 7, 9, verse 29, and 31, and chapter 10, and verse 3. So, introduced into the pagan environment then that we've been thinking about, this hugely violent and dangerous and decadent time, was a man who was of Jewish birth. And alongside him comes a lady that he is looking after, Esther. So if we pick the record up in Esther chapter 2 and there at verse 8, so it came to pass when the king's commandment and his decree was heard, and when many maidens were gathered together unto Shushan the palace to the custody of Hegai, that Esther was brought also unto the king's house to the custody of Hegai, keeper of the women. In fact, in the New King James Version, it reads Esther was taken, and that's the revised version too. So it doesn't look as though she was volunteered, that Mordecai pushed her forward. Mordecai may well be aligned, as far as Herodotus is concerned, with someone who had journeyed and travelled with the king when the king was off on his Greek expedition, and that is possible. And it is sometimes argued that, in fact, what he was now doing was increasing his promotion potential by pushing his niece forward so that she could go and be there in a position of influence and importance. But we can't be entirely sure about that. The names are more complicated in that particular situation. We'll come back to that a little later on in the consideration. Esther herself, Ishtar, as she would be in Babylonian terms, is in fact again named after a Babylonian goddess, but also has a Hebrew name, Hadassah, which means myrtle. And a little while back, there were a few myrtles around. Is there a myrtle present? Do we see a myrtle in the house? We don't. It's a name that's gone out of fashion now, but it has some important significance as far as the record is concerned. So Esther was taken. Well, it may have been that Esther was of such outstanding beauty that there was no way in which you could keep her under wraps, and that everybody in Shushan knew that she was a most beautiful woman, and everybody was saying, excuse me, why hasn't Esther been brought forward then? Where's Esther when this beauty parade is taking place? It said, remember, that she was one of the most beautiful Jewish women that has ever been. Sarah, Bathsheba, and Esther are reckoned to be the trio of the most beautiful. So it may be that there was no way you could keep her away, and that she had to go, and Mordecai would have been sad to see her go, and in fact exercises a lot of care as far as he is able when she is taken into the harem. But you'll notice that immediately she comes over as a pleasant person. The young women pleased Hegai, the custodian of the women. She obtained his favor. He readily gave beauty preparations to her besides her allowance. And seven choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace. He moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. Esther had not revealed her people or family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. And that again is a matter of some contention. Why was it that Mordecai said, don't let on that you're a Jewess? And again, we can't be certain why. It may have been that he didn't think it would help, It doesn't seem to matter that people were of Jewish origin. After all, Daniel had been very prominent in Persian government, even after the fall of the Babylonian regime. But, of course, under the hand of God, it turns out to be important that she had not revealed her nationality. But how did Mordecai know? Well, we have to understand that he was given to know in some way or another, in ways that are not shown us. So it was then that Esther began the long process of purification. Remember, it's going to be there at verse 16 that it's the seventh year of the king's reign, 479 BC, when she actually comes into the king's presence. And in the process, she has to engage in all of these ritual purifications. I suppose it was like going to a beauty spa or a health farm and being cosseted and prepared and purified for all that purpose and process of time. But of course, you are not your own any longer. You are subject to the authority and control of the eunuchs. You become, in effect, a slave within the harem. You're not going to be able to nip out to shop in the local handbag salon. You're just going to have to do whatever you are told to do. Each young woman's turn came to go into King Ahasuerus after she had completed 12 months preparation, according to the regulations for the women. For thus were the days of their preparation apportioned: 6 months with oil of myrrh, 6 months with perfumes and preparations for beautifying women. Thus prepared, each young woman went to the king. You can imagine that the king's chambers were quite scented in those particular days. And as one woman followed another, he must have thought, different Chanel perfume this time, and such like. And no doubt they did try to be distinct. And one suggestion is that Esther, in fact, was more chaste and less forthcoming than any of the other women when, in course of time, she came into the king's presence. I mean, it is unsavory, isn't it, this whole incident? I mean, I used to think that maybe the king was such a nice man that he'd just spend the evening chatting with them and decided which one was the most attractive to him as far as a mental companion was concerned. But once you know what his sexual appetite was like, you know that he was a ruthless and a vicious and a sensual man. And so it was a surprise, it has to be said, when Esther at last came into the king's presence and the king was much taken by her. Look what the record says. The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So that under the hand of God, it was Esther who was to be chosen, and it was Esther who turned the king's heart. This vicious man, this cruel, this brutal man, this man who was prepared to go to the ends of the earth to try and get his own way, and yet he was uncertain in domestic matters. He is now the king who chooses Esther and sets the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Incidentally, she inherited all of Vashti's possessions. Do you remember back in chapter 1? All Vashti had was lost to the new queen. So she would become an influential and an affluent woman. And nevertheless, she would never be able to leave the harem without escort, and she would be limited and restricted in what she was able to do. The king made a great feast. Well, he's a party animal, and the feast of Esther was declared for all his officials and servants. He proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of a king. And you might notice that when Prince Harry decided to marry Meghan Markle, he's doing it on a Saturday just so that a bank holiday doesn't have to be thrown. But no doubt there will be a party in the palace. In fact, I think it's already been arranged that Prince William will be allowed to slip away from the party and go to the cup final, the football cup final that's taking place on that very same day. So you see how carefully all these things are being orchestrated and arranged, and it was the same here. Everything had happened in what would appear to be a random and to us a somewhat haphazard fashion, but there it was that in the very centre of the palace now, there was a queen who turns out to be a Jewess. When the king's decree which he will make is proclaimed throughout all his empire, for it is great, all wives will honour their husbands, both great and small. And there is the name of God, the memorial name of God to be found, the first occurrence. In the outworking of that purpose, before even Esther or Mordecai had come into the frame, there is the hand of God to be seen, working behind the scenes, displacing Vashti and preparing the time when someone else would seize the king's affections. And who would that person be but a Jewess? So what have we learned? Well, we've learned that the Bible is absolutely historically reliable. Never doubt it. Some really useful studies have been made to coincide the book of Esther with the history of the times in the way that we've been working through and looking at them. And God lets some very strange people indeed rule over the kingdoms of men. And Xerxes, it has to be said, was one of those, a strange man indeed. He returned disconsolate from Greece and now spent his endeavours building up the palace that was at Shushan and making it a place of magnificence, as you might expect. But he was not a nice man, to say the least. And God always has his people's welfare in mind. So that although we couldn't see that there was any need or necessity, God knew that there would come a time when his people's welfare would be critical, and God was prepared for that. And it has to be said that very often the ways of God are far beyond our appreciation or understanding. We just don't know what God is doing in the world or how things are going to work out. But God knows, and that's the critical thing. And just as in Esther's case, she was brought into a situation that might not have been of her choosing. Well, sometimes when we're asked to do something, we just have to believe in the purpose of God and have to believe that God always knows best. So that if we allow providence to work in our lives, although sometimes events are inexplicable, nevertheless, we believe that God is working there. It is God that worketh in us, both to will and to do of his good pleasure, says the Apostle Paul, remember, in Philippians. And so it was to turn out to be in this situation. God is to be found in the most unlikely places. And here then in the book of Esther we find a most unlikely outcome. But I suppose if we're summarising and wondering just how things were going, well, as far as Esther was concerned, so far so good. There she was, in a position of power and prestige, situated in the king's palace, in his heart and in his affections. Well, what could possibly go wrong? Well, you know that things were going to go badly wrong.